I want to talk a bit about leadership on a pedestal, because most leadership is lived out on one kind of pedestal or another. You know, it's going to be true whether you're a business executive, a football club manager, a church minister. Now, some build their own pedestals. They're always talking about their achievements and their qualities. Others find their fan base, whether it's in the company or the club or even the church family, puff them up. And still others discover that the media does the work for them. Living on a pedestal gives a leader a standing, a status, an authority with which to lead, but staying there is so difficult. And falling off the pedestal brings huge disappointment. You know, when the media turns and tears down the legend it created, when results fade, and shareholders and fans and even congregations prove fickle, when realities dawn and Achilles' heels become obvious, it can be a massive letdown. Remember when someone talking to me about the ups and downs, the excitements and the disappointments about leaders, and their theory went something like this: when someone's been in charge for 7 years or so, their weaknesses become as obvious as their strengths. And if they go on much longer, there can come a time when those weaknesses, at least in some people's minds, can outweigh their strengths. So much so that you choose the successor because he or she doesn't share the weaknesses. It's why the early years of new leadership can be so wonderful, until you discover the new leader doesn't share the predecessor's strengths either. Then life gets more difficult again. But the pedestal always seems to lead to disappointment, and it can be an ugly moment when dreams evaporate. We were discussing this around the ministry team table last week. We were talking about the need to come clean about our weaknesses and climb down from the pedestal. And Jenny Brown, in her usual tactful, sensitive way, just said to me, Hugh, I'm sure you've got this in mind and you'll find a way of putting it, but I hope you're going to make this personal. She said, it would be good, really, to share some of your weaknesses. And I saw eyes light up all around the table from the ministry team. And, you know, Barrows came out and they started scribbling. And I thought, at least I'm not going to have to lie awake all night trying to think of my weakness. It'll just be a question of editing from the lists I'm about to be given. And we all seem united on this until Wanyeki suddenly said that he kept meeting leaders who said that instead of their church families being encouraged when they were open about their weaknesses, their congregations began to despise them. Well, that immediately meant everyone started hesitating. And Rico, never one to hold back, immediately sort of followed through and said, well, yeah, of course, that's true here. He said, I mean, the staff can crack up, but the leader can't. At which point, advice dried up from round the table, and I realized we'd have to look to the Bible for wisdom. Well, something of those fears and that letdown seems to be in the apostle's mind as he writes this chapter. And it's directed at those who put others on pedestals as well as those who climb up them themselves. Look at verse 20, for example. I don't know whether you spotted this as Nick was reading. See verse 20, I'm afraid that when I come, I may not find you as I want you to be. He's afraid that he'll find the Corinthians so busy building and admiring the pedestals for their leaders, so distracted from what would really matter, that Paul will find a church shot through with, well, what he mentions in verse 20, discord, selfish ambition, slander, gossip, arrogance, disorder. And while they're busy squabbling and dividing over leaders, they'll have turned a blind eye to sins they should have been repenting of, the sins of verse 21. Now, it cuts both ways, of course, because the Corinthians will face their own disappointment, an apostle who does not match their expectations, a leader who's fallen off the pedestal, so to speak, and that is the other fear you see in verse 20, don't you? I may not find you as I want you to be, and you may not find me as you want me to be. So this chapter's written to avoid the disillusioned ending. And it begins with Paul still boasting as he tries to reshape expectations. Come back to the beginning of the chapter and verse 1. See, I must go on boasting. Although there's nothing to be gained, I will go on to visions and revelations from the Lord. Well, as we've seen in this series, any leader who's going to cut it in Corinth will need to shine in the wisdom department. And what better way than by having a stream of supernatural visions and revelations from the Lord? If you were with us last week, you'll remember that Paul's bragging was something of a send-up. If I must boast, I'll boast of my weaknesses, he'd said, and he listed all his sufferings and persecutions and deprivations. But now in this chapter, it's a real boast, isn't it? A real vision. Oh, it sounds at first like something that happened to someone else. I mean, look how verse 2 begins. I know a man in Christ who. But the further the story goes on, the more obvious it becomes he has to be talking about himself. Our speakers still do that kind of thing. You know, they say, I have a friend who. Most of us are quite friendly with ourselves, you know. Someone I know very well once said, I know myself pretty well. It's Paul who was caught up into paradise, and he saw and heard things so intimately wonderful they can't even be passed on. Yet, listen carefully, and you'll see the pedestal never even gets off the ground. And as you listen, spot these lessons. Here's the first one. I've called it the danger of being too spiritual. Well, of course, you can't be too spiritual unless it's in the sense of those super apostle types with super spiritual ideas that mean God's only working when he works supernaturally. Which will mean ideas aren't enough to lead anyone by any more than agreed proposals or thought through ways forward. The leader will need to bring a picture or a word from the Lord to the table to carry the day. A leader worth following can be expected to be in intimate communication with the Almighty. Well, Paul can actually fit the bill. I mean, this story illustrates that, but it carries several warnings as well. Here's the first of them, I think. The warning about a false norm. Paul has his vision, but he doesn't for a moment pretend that it's the norm. Look back to verse 2 again. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven, to paradise. Now, we know from Luke's writing in Acts, for example, that this wasn't the only vision Paul had, so he selects it, presumably, to make his points. A great, true, wonderful, breathtaking vision 14 years ago. I mean, think about it. It's like you interviewing me for a job here today. And you want to check out my leadership style, and you ask me, well, what about visions from the Lord, Hugh? What part do they play? Do you have them? And if I was to come back to you and say, oh, yes, certainly. Why, in 1998, I really wouldn't need to say much more, would I? 1998, I mean, that is last century. You know, you would be concluding visions are not the norm, they're not the staple diet of my leadership. Or the apostles. He warns of the danger of not just a false norm, but what are called a false measure. Because even as he speaks of the inexpressible things he heard and insists the vision was true, Paul rejects it as a measuring stick for someone's worth. That's what he's saying in verse 6, isn't it? But I refrain from boasting about it, so that no one will think more of me than is warranted by what I do or say. The measure of a man, a woman's worth is not what personal visions or revelations they claim from the Lord, but our actions and our speech. They reveal our true spirituality. Or he goes on, no one will think more of me than is warranted because of these surpassingly great revelations. He won't rely on them for his standing. He refuses to allow them to be built into his pedestal. I say, the Lord has given me this picture. You think, wow, isn't Hugh spiritual? And I may be. But God's given us far more verifiable measuring rods of our relationship with him in our everyday speech and action. Watch them. They'll tell you if I'm really walking closely with the Lord. And another danger he wants to highlight is what I've called a false pride. A false pride. Because it's not just others who can be deceived into flattering estimates by such visions. The visionary is all too vulnerable as well. And Paul learned that the hard way. You see, verse 7? Therefore, in order to keep me from being conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me. In order to keep me from being conceited. To stop him getting ideas above his station, a pride based on a false, inflated estimate of himself. To stop him becoming like one of these new leaders, these super apostles, who are full of themselves and lording it over the Corinthian church. That's why he's been given a thorn in my flesh. Now, no one knows what it actually was. By the way, in that one short, simple sentence, I've saved you reading at least 10 pages worth of almost any commentary on 2 Corinthians. No one knows what it actually was. Almost certainly something physical rather than sinful, a weakness, not a sin, or it wouldn't have been allowed to stay as it was. But whether it was his fading eyesight, a disfigurement, a stammer, some arthritic joint pain, I mean, no one knows, and we don't need to know. The lessons of the thorn in the flesh can apply across the whole range of possibilities, and they're meant for our thorns in the flesh today as well. And the first lesson is this: it was an antidote to the danger of pride and conceit. A danger as real as the thorn was, and it was real, wasn't it? You know, a messenger of Satan to torment me. A danger for as godly a person as the Apostle Paul, never mind the rest of us. The pain, the handicap, the blemish was to be a constant reminder not to get carried away with himself, not to read too much into his privileged experience that he'd enjoyed. And if God should entrust you with some experience like that, well, don't be so spiritual, don't be so super spiritual as to imagine it determines your ranking or importance as a Christian. And if God gives such experiences to people you know, don't use that to start building a pedestal to put them on. The danger of being too spiritual. Here's the other lesson for us this morning. What I've called the power of coming off the pedestal. The power of coming off the pedestal. Because if it's pride that's put me on the pedestal, my pride or others' pride in me, then the danger I'm in could hardly be spelt out more clearly than in this next verse. This thorn in the flesh that's been given Paul to keep him from being conceited. But you can almost hear him, can't you, as the lesson registers saying, look, point taken, warning heard. So verse 8, three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But the Lord wouldn't. I mean, the danger was that big. The pain, the handicap, the loss of face that came with the thorn are better than the pride that might come without it. Pride is like that. It's surprisingly lethal. You know, we think of sin and we run our checklists and they begin with, well, I don't know what yours begins with, but, you know, sex and drink and violence and theft, and we'll probably add in some other subtler ones like slander and gossip. It rarely tests pride. Very hard to look at verse 8 though, isn't it, and not to hear echoes of the Garden of Gethsemane and Jesus praying three times. Father, if it's possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not my will but yours be done. Well, then, as here, the prayer's answered, but not how the prayer hoped. The Father's will was done, but there was no escaping the cross for Jesus. And here Paul is going to discover the fullest of Christian lives, but with the thorn, not without it. And if there's some thorn in the flesh that you're pleading with the Lord to remove from you, look very carefully at what he says next, will you? Verse 9, but he, the Lord, said to me. By the way, I wonder, is this another revelation, just in passing? Because it's very hard to imagine any of us would guess what's coming next. But the Lord said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. Your Christian life won't be limited. My grace is sufficient. There's enough of it for you in spite of the thorn. Which is easy to say, but even easier to forget, isn't it? we doubt it so quickly. Living with pain can be very draining. You don't need much of a toothache to know that. Living with handicap can be very frustrating. My grace is sufficient. I could be so much more Christian if only I didn't have... I mean, which of us hasn't at one time or another prayed a prayer like that? Particularly if the thorn is kind of getting under our skin. My grace is sufficient for you. That's God's promise. It's God's promise to claim every morning. It's God's promise we probably have to claim every morning. I remember when I was a curate serving in my first parish up in Norwich, I was asked once to visit an old lady. I was told she'd once been a missionary in South America, but now she was bedridden in a care home. And I remember as I was walking over to it, thinking, I mean, here am I in my 20s, fit, healthy at what passed for my physical prime, wondering, what on earth have I got to say to her? And the answer was very little, of course, but I discovered I got so much to learn from her and her infectious love for and joy in the Lord. My grace is sufficient for you was so true in her case. It meant a relationship with the Lord more vibrant, more alive, more real, without her ever leaving her bed, than I'd begun to know for all my youth and energy and fitness. Kept going back and back, not to help her, but to be encouraged by her. All the same, you can't really miss the apostle's frustrations as he kneels and prays and pleads, can you? You know, Lord, they're the best of frustrations. There's so much more I want to do for you. People won't listen to me with this stammer. I can't write the way I used to with my eyesight as it is now. But verse 9, the Lord said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. You see what he's saying? Your Christian life won't be limited. Your Christian ministry won't be restricted. For those overwhelmed with feelings of inadequacy and worthlessness when it comes to ministry, here is your encouragement. Powerful ministry comes not from your strength, but God's grace. That almost instinctive reaction that many people have when they're asked to take on some responsibility or leadership. I'm not up to it. It's a great starting place for ministry when you've looked at verse 9. Remember one guy coming to me, he'd been asked to take on a responsibility and he was trying to check out with me whether he should do it or not. And he kept saying, I'm not up to it. And he went on and on about not being up to it. I began to sort of wonder if he was just saying it because he thought that's what I wanted to hear. And I remember at the end saying to him, well, it's got to be your decision. You need to take it on willingly. But let me just say this. I'd hate you to do it when you feel you are up to it. Because then we would have missed verse 9. And for those of us aware that we have been given gifts to use, tempted by feelings of adequacy, not inadequacy, well, here's our challenge. We imagine verse 9 is just God promising to overcome handicap. It's not. Look at what he says. My power can work even through weakness. No. My power is made perfect in weakness. My power works best in weakness. So I can't experience that power while I stay on the pedestal. And it's so difficult, so counterintuitive to climb down off it. Some of us have to be pushed and pulled to get off it. I see, I want power, but no weakness. I instinctively think power and strength are what go together. I suspect if you took that sentence and took it outside onto the street and just tested people out and saw, can they finish it? God says that my power is made perfect in, how would you finish the sentence? Who knows what people would come up with? My learning, my education and training, my passion, my diplomacy and people skills, my oratory, my flair. The list can go on and on of things we can take pride in. But God says, and he should know because it is his power, my power is made perfect in weakness. Weakness.
And our hearts don't naturally go there.
See, forget for a moment your disappointments and frustrations with All Souls. Imagine your friend has been converted here in the last week, or you've been hugely, genuinely encouraged. And on the way out, as you pass me, you just say, "Hugh, the Lord's doing great things here." I'll smile. I mean, that's a wonderful encouragement, isn't it? Or you go out and you say, "Hugh, All Souls is a wonderful church." And my smile will be broader. Well, I mean, there's some reflected glory to bask in, isn't there? I'm the rector of All Souls. Or you go out and you say, "Hugh, your leadership's great. We really sense the Lord's presence here in All Souls." I'll be smiling from ear to ear. And then I'll have to look at verse 9 again. "My power is made perfect in weakness." And the warning that is as to where that smile and that proud heart can take us. And as Paul generalizes from his particular thorn, you see how verse 9 goes on, "Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me." He's not talking up his weaknesses for the sake of it. He knows where the power lies, and he wants to keep eyes, his and the Corinthians, on the Lord, not on himself. But the challenge to any of us who find ourselves up a pedestal is this: will we climb down off it? Now remember, when Paul talks about weakness, he does not mean sinfulness. His list tells of hardship and persecution and handicap, not immorality and wrongdoing. But he's not in denial of giftings and strengths. It's not a charter for incompetence. I think it was Winston Churchill who once described someone as a humble person with plenty to be humble about. If he didn't say it, it's the kind of thing he would have said. Well, that actually isn't Paul. Now, what's striking as you read this is the kind of CV he could have written. I mean, I don't know whether you caught it as Nick read verse 12, but it's just one example. He talks of demonstrating among you the marks of a true apostle, including signs, wonders, and miracles. They were part of his ministry. But you see, he knows where the power lies. And when that's all we want to talk about in someone's ministry, their signs, wonders, and miracles, we show we don't know where the power lies. "My power is made perfect in weakness." So will we climb down off the pedestal? You sense, don't you, that Paul's even stopped praying for the thorn to be taken away. He can look at this messenger of Satan, as he described it back in verse 7, see what Satan intended to be debilitating and frustrating and limiting, and see now God using it to keep him usable. I wonder if you can look at your own thorn like that, or if it's still just a messenger from Satan for you. "My power is made perfect in weakness." But it is unnatural to climb off the pedestal. Countercultural. Every culture wants leaders it can be proud of because they're strong. Evangelical Christians look for that as well. They expect their leaders to have answers for every issue. They want their preachers to be decisively, entertainingly, engagingly, not just right, but right on the button. I have to confess, much of my week is spent being out of my depth. Yeah, the pastoral issue where the pain is so obvious, the solution so elusive. The constant pressure on priorities as good causes, gospel causes, clamour for our attention and time and money and buildings. It's so hard to discern when you should say yes and when no. The sermon or talks that need grappling with, the management decisions that need making, the school that needs me to face the inspector as chair of governors, as I had to do the other week, and so on and so on. Far from the rector who is so spiritually alert that he effortlessly, decisively dispenses wisdom, makes decision, rolls out talks and sermons, devotedly loves his family, you've got me. And I'm constantly having to cry out, "Help, Lord." I confess, I often leave awkward emails until tomorrow, in the illogical thought that they might be easier to answer on Wednesday than they were on Tuesday. You know, I will frequently ask a Jenny Brown or a Mark Mennell, what would they advise in this situation? I know what it is to battle the rising tide of panic as Sunday approaches, the sermon looms large, and still I can't really crack the passage, never mind communicate it. You've got a rector who this week went home and nodded off after a meal while my daughter was trying to explain her difficult day, which gave me one more pastoral situation to have to handle. I mean, that's the reality, and yet my heart still toys with the attraction of being up on a pedestal. And I have to remind it, my power is made perfect in weakness. And tomorrow's Monday. And the week starts all over again, and we have to take a deep breath, get out of bed, and put ourselves through it once more. No, nothing like that. If you've only got my pressures, you can offset them with the wonders of the gospel, the privilege of being set apart to share it and enjoy it. But for others, it is very different. Even for some in this room, they can echo far more closely, well, the way for Paul it involves all kinds of hardship. You notice in verse 10 he speaks about insults and hardships and persecutions and difficulties. For him it meant no income, no pension, a prison record, brutal floggings. What made him peel himself off the whipping post and preach again the message that put him there in the first place? It's almost harder to imagine why you go round and do it again. What made him pick himself up after being left for dead following a stoning, you know, straighten his tie, put a comb through his hair, head back into the city and tell them again about Jesus? My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. What else is going to get us to go through it again? And he'll head back to these awkward, fickle, gullible, heartbreaking Corinthians. He'll be humiliated by them again because he loves them. That's what he said in verse 14, isn't it? Now, I'm ready to visit you for the third time and I won't be a burden to you. I'll pay my own way again because what I want is not your possessions. Like the super apostles after your checkbooks. What I want is not your possessions, but you. You. No one climbs down off the pedestal for attention or the money. It was love that meant Jesus came down off a pedestal that never flattered him and would never bring disappointment and became weak, was humiliated even to the point of thorns rammed into his flesh and nails into his hands and feet. The love that gave Jesus and that took him to the cross is the love that our last song's all about. So let's take up our service sheets and sing of how deep the Father's love for us is.